This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of the New Yorker and WNYC Studios.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. For the past 25 years, starting when she was all of 14 years old, the singer Robin has been on the cutting edge of pop music. Her sound is sparse, complex, ahead of the trends, and she always seems like she's writing from a few years into the future. For most of those 25 years making music, Robin has avoided the big hit-making producers who somehow put their own stamp on an artist. Instead, she's become almost an oxymoron, an indie pop star. And while she's respected, even frankly adored by so many critics, she's also genuinely popular, with the top 10 singles and multiple Grammy nominations to prove it. Robin was born Robin Carlson in Sweden, where she still lives. And her last album, Body Talk, came out in 2010. But for most of the intervening years, Robin has been pretty much out of public view. Following a breakup and a close friend's death, she slipped into a depression serious enough that she had trouble getting out of bed sometimes or leaving the house. She eventually started recording again and recently released an album called Honey. The New Yorker's Gia Tolentino said of it, "The force of her conviction continues to hold together what often seems impossible, musically or otherwise. Maximum sadness felt as the bedrock of absolute joy." Robin talked with me from her office in Sweden last week. Robin, this is your first album in 8 years. Is it strange to be back in the limelight after all that time? You're touring, and it's been a long time for touring, too. What's it like being back out in the hot lights?
It's nice. I'm enjoying myself. Maybe in a way I'm in a different place than I was last time I released an album, in the sense that I'm maybe not as, like, how can I put it? Not as, like, willing maybe to work as hard. Like, I really enjoy my downtime. I really enjoy being in the studio. I really enjoy, like, having my own time, basically.
You wrote your first song when you were 11 years old, which is pretty darn early. What were you listening to? What singers, what music was meaning the most to you? You signed with a record company at 14. So a lot of music must have been coming at you, shaping this young voice, this young singer, this young composer. I wonder what was most important.
I loved Michael Jackson. I listened to Off the Wall and Thriller a lot. I think I heard my first Prince album when I was about 8. It was the Batman soundtrack. and I loved it. I still do, actually. I think it's an underrated... I mean, I think TLC made maybe the biggest impression on me as a teenager, because they were young women and they were, you know, quite tough and, like, strong and still girly and cute and fun. I think they were probably the group. If you would have asked me, you know, as a 15-year-old, I would have said TLC.
And when you listen to that, those early songs of yours, that early music, and it's now quite a while ago, it's almost 20 years ago, what are you hearing in the young Robin?
I think I'm hearing, you know, a lot of, like, will, a lot of willpower, a lot of, like, energy. Sometimes I feel like I can understand where I was trying to move in a different direction, but maybe really didn't know how. And it took me a long time until I actually created the environment where I felt like I could make music that was more on my own terms. But I think the fact that I was writing still gave me like an outlet.
When you were just 18, you released My Truth. And though your first album was released in the United States, this one was not. Mm-hmm. What happened?
Well, I just don't think that the label that I worked with at the time got it. You know, it wasn't a commercial album.
But you were writing about your experience in abortion, and that's something that most American pop stars certainly wouldn't touch at the time. And not only did you sing about it, you refused to make any changes in order to reach some imagined big audience. Mm-hmm. That seems a pretty tough thing to do, no? What was that episode like for you?
Well, I don't think it was a tough decision. I was more kind of amazed of, like, how narrow-minded the label I was with at the time was. Not here in Sweden, but in America, I think that song became an issue. That wasn't a big deal for me, actually. I'm happy that I wrote the song and that I kind of stuck by it. So I knew you would, and I never imagined you'd be so good. And it hurts me so to let you go. I want you to live, but I'm not all I want to give.
What's your process like as a writer of songs?
I think writing continuously, like having a routine, is really important, at least for me. But then I really believe also that some ideas, they just show up when they're ready. You might have to, like, get the engine, like, going and warm it up for a long time, but, like, once it's, like, ready, once you're, like, in the zone, it's easier for those ideas to show up. And I don't know where that comes from. I mean, I'm not superstitious in that way. I wouldn't say that I think they come from God, because I don't feel like I believe in God, but I believe in that they come from the unconsciousness, like a deeper place that's harder to get to by thinking.
Well, something equally mysterious happened after Body Talk came out. After it came out, you were a huge success, a big star, 5 albums. And then suddenly you went, at least where the public was concerned, silent. Are you able to talk about what happened and why you withdrew from your public life?
Well, I mean, I was ready to make an album in 2014. I was preparing to, like, go back into the studio. And then, you know, I think, like, for a lot of people, life was just, you know, unexpected things happened. And
you experienced some real losses at that time.
Yeah, exactly. A friend of mine died, and I was in a relationship that ended around the same time. I felt like the things that I was trying to, or the things that I was writing about, were quite, you know, layered and complex. They weren't quick. like Missing You is a really good example. I wrote the melody and, like, the beginning of the lyrics in 2014, in July. And Christian died just right after that, and my friend, and I really didn't know how to finish those lyrics at that point. because it started out as a love song, and then it became about, you know, my friend that had passed away, and then the relationship I was in kind of fell apart, and then it became more about that, you know. So it was like this ongoing thing of like where my experiences were just changing all the time, and I didn't know how to put all of that into the lyrics. So I just kind of left the song. I worked on other things, even though it was slow and it took time. But I was, you know, I was preparing. I was exploring myself, I guess, in order to be able to put words on all of those experiences eventually. There's this empty space you left behind. Now you're not here with me.
I keep digging through a waste of time. But the picture, you did something that's pretty unusual in the modern world. A lot of people go see a therapist to deal with depression or loss or heartbreak or whatever it might be. You went into it in a way that in the modern world doesn't happen very much anymore. So you went several times a week into real, what I guess is some traditional psychoanalysis. I wonder, what was the effects on your life and what was the effects on your work of that psychoanalytical work that you were doing?
I started it way before I started making this album, like years before. But it wasn't until all these things happened in my life where I really felt like it started to kind of give like real results. You know, I think the therapy definitely had an effect on my music, but I also think that, you know, these things that happened in my life basically also changed my therapy. It was like, you know, it's like it works both ways, I think. But the commitment of going to psychoanalysis is a big one. You have to do it for some years. And I guess looking back at it now, I can kind of see how you never really know when it's going to start making sense. You just kind of have to commit anyway.
I'd like to break down, if you don't mind, the musical elements of Honey. So let's start by listening to a clip of that. Can you describe the writing of that, the figuring out of the melody and the part that you're singing?
So I was working with this Casio synthesizer for a long time, and I was making songs on these chords that me and Marcus, who plays in my band, and it was really just about the beat for me for like a year or so.
And you're playing around with kind of club music background here, right?
That was what I was doing, but it sounded like something else. We had this like idea of making this like gooey kind of soft production that was still mm-hmm. relating to, you know, club music, and Joseph decided to like make his own sample. So we called it like the sauce. It's processed through, you know, lots of things to make it kind of feel like it's moving. And I think, to me, that's really what club music is about.
So I want to ask a question that's more about pop music in general. Pop music, dance music, it's a lot of it is associated with sex, with hyper-sexualized imagery, a lot of it, for years and years. And you've somehow avoided that. You sing about love and sex, but you don't sexualize or over-sexualize your own image or who you are in these songs. And that seems a kind of magic trick too. Is it something you think about a lot?
I actually don't. I wish I maybe thought about it more. I think that for me, it was always, like, when I was younger, very, like, important, or I just felt like I needed to kind of protect myself. I think today it's much easier to, you know, have pink hair and at the same time call yourself a feminist. And I think when I was growing up, being a feminist was like, you know, being a tomboy was or felt liberating to me. And I think I was. So I don't think that I, like, gave myself space enough to be a sensual person as an artist until way later. And I like things to be layered. I like things to be complicated and complex. And I think if you're allowing things to be, you know, somehow complicated, you can be as sexy as you want, you know.
Robin, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for talking to me.
All the best to you, and good luck in everything.
Yeah, you too. Thank you. Bye.
Robin's album Honey came out in the fall. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
Aaron Sorkin is probably best known for The West Wing, and he won an Academy Award for a screenplay for The Social Network, the movie about Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg. But Sorkin's roots are on the stage, in live theater, and he's adapted Harper Lee's novel To Kill a Mockingbird. The show opens on Broadway this month, and I'll talk with Sorkin next week on the New Yorker Radio Hour. Well, it is that time of year again, and the lists are coming fast and furious. And thank God I've got Amanda Petrusich here to guide us through the year in pop music. Amanda, what's the best thing you've been hearing all year? What just blew your mind?
For me, the big kind of pop music story of 2018 was Ariana Grande. She was the first woman in 3 years to have a single debut at number one on the Hot 100. But what's really remarkable, I think, about her and about her kind of journey and story this year is, you know, she endured this extraordinary tragedy. There was a bombing at a concert she gave in Manchester in the United Kingdom in 2017, you know, 23 people dead. She returned home. Her ex-boyfriend and former collaborator, the rapper Mac Miller, passed away of an accidental overdose. She became engaged to SNL's Pete Davidson, and then that engagement was called off. And throughout all of this, she released a record, sort of in the midst of all this turmoil in her life, called Sweetener. And the record is sort of, it's a beautiful pop record, and I think just kind of inspiring and lovely in its embrace of, you know, the idea of survival and sort of remaining. And you know, she's 25 years old, and the kind of way in which she sort of approaches the things she's endured, I just find incredible. I mean, I think, God, at that age, I would have been collapsed by all of that. I would have been just totally destroyed by those events. But she released a single just a few weeks ago called Thank You, Next. I don't know if you have had a chance
to. I have
to.
Heard it.
It's a kind of kiss-off to Pete Davidson, I suppose. You kind of, you know, at least for
who,
me.
Who would kiss off Pete Davidson? Yeah.
Imagine that.
It's kind of unbelievable.
I know. But she released this single, Thank You, Next, that you would have assumed would have been this kind of malevolent, you know, I'm moving on. The title seems to suggest as much. But what's incredible about it is that the chorus has this line, and I will keep this clean for the airwaves. I don't want to work blue. But it's basically, I'm so grateful for my ex. And I just think, who is grateful for their ex, you know? Again, at 25, I certainly did not have the generosity of spirit. Neither at 35 did I have the generosity of spirit to be grateful for my exes. But she is. She remains.
That's something
to
think on.
Yeah.
That is something to think on. Let's hear it.
Thought I'd end up with Sean, but it wasn't a match. Wrote some songs about Ricky. Now I listen and laugh. Even almost got married. Pete, I'm so thankful. Wish I could say thank you to Malcolm, 'cause he was an angel. One taught me love, one taught me patience, and one taught me pain. Now I'm so amazing to have loved and I've lost. That's not what I see. So look what I got. Look what you taught me. Yeah, for that I say thank you. Next, thank you.
I'm tempted to say it, but I'll say it. Thank you. Next. What have we got next? What else is on your mind and what else is on the list?
I hope that phrase really works its way into your editing vernacular.
I don't think that's going to be a good style.
Papers flying off the desk.
I don't think they'd appreciate it.
Well, my favorite pop single of 2018 was Malamente by the Catalonian singer Rosalia. Her second album is based loosely on an anonymous 13th century poem about the psychic perils of jealousy. So she sort of had me there. It's a record about desire, when desire goes wrong, and particularly the kind of ramifications for women when love turns ugly. So the title translates to badly, and the song itself mixes these kind of traditional flamenco rhythms with elements of pop and reggaeton and hip-hop and R&B. She sings in Spanish, but the lyrics are really spooky, really foreboding, really dark, which for me was in line with, you know, much of 2018, where you're just thinking, God, what awful and terrifying thing lurks around the next corner. And I feel like this song really sort of captured that feeling. It's this sort of cascading series of bad portents, you know, a broken light, voice on the stairs, a dream about a bridge.
Stop, you're cheering me up. You're cheering me up.
Happy holidays. So why don't we listen to a little bit of Rosalia's Malamente?
Ese gritarito roto.
Oh, I've heard this.
Yeah, it's cool.
I have heard this.
She's cool. I think she's going to have a big year next year.
Well, most top 10 lists are, you know, 10. But, you know, in the age of diminishing expectations or shortened attention spans, here's our final one. The final big hit of 2018 from Amanda is...
See, now you have built me up, and it is what I'm about to play is, in fact, not a big hit, but a little under-the-radar gem, which I figured out we've got, you know, we've got
if you say it's a big hit, it's a big hit.
Yeah, okay. I declare this the jam of 2018. This is by a banjo player named Nathan Bowles. Did I lose you at banjo player?
I'm right there with
You're with me. The album is called Plainly Mistaken. He is a North Carolina-based musician, known primarily for his drumming, but every once in a while will release one of these extraordinary banjo records. And he is equally informed by sort of traditional Appalachian song, kind of old-time mountain music, but also a sort of avant-garde New York City experimental kind of drone minimalist thing. So it hits all my walls in that way. It's a kind of Roscoe Holcomb meets John Cale. And one of my favorite songs from this record is called Now If You Remember.
Appalachian trance music.
Yeah, exactly.
Love that.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Well, happy holidays to you and happy holidays to everyone. This is at least the beginning of a revelatory list from Amanda, who I think will probably write a longer list online
pretty soon.
I will,
absolutely.
Amanda Petrusic, music writer extraordinaire for The New Yorker. Thanks so much.
Thank you, David.
Amanda Petrusic with three of her favorites this year, Ariana Grande's Sweetener, Rosalia's Malamente, and Nathan Bowles, whose album is called Plainly Mistaken. In the operatic canon, there is no shortage of tragic deaths. By any measure, one of the most awful is the murder of Desdemona by her husband, Othello. The themes of Verdi's opera, like the Shakespeare play it's based on, remain sadly all too contemporary. Racism, power, jealousy, how resentment leads to bitterness and appalling violence. A production of Othello is at the Metropolitan Opera in New York, and while the show was in rehearsal, The New Yorker's David Cortava got a look behind the scenes at how violence makes its way to the opera stage.
Into the bowels of the net.
B.H. Barry is a fight director at the Metropolitan Opera. Who knew such a job existed? But if somebody is attacking somebody else while somehow singing at top volume, B.H. Barry has work to do. And to see how it's all done, he took David Cortava way, way down under the big stage.
There are people still trying to get out of here from 2 years ago. The maze is just incredible.
B.H. Barry is one of the leading fight directors in the world. He's a kind of master of a lot of different kinds of violence. Huge barroom brawls, intimate knife fights, stranglings, slaps, beheadings, fist fights, a pogrom and Fiddler on the Roof. But he's not a bruiser. He's not a barroom brawler. He's a very elegant-looking gentleman in his 70s. He has a bouncy tuft of silver hair. He seems like an old-timey action movie star, like an Errol Flynn or a Douglas Fairbanks. And like those people, he is very good with a sword.
Normally, whenever there's action in a play that involves actors, I'm asked to come in to protect them, to build a choreographed scene in which they won't get hurt. And so that's part of the job. The other part of the job is, as a fight director, is being able to teach, because a lot of people can't do this stuff. And a lot of opera singers are not necessarily physical people. because to be an opera singer, you really have to work incredibly hard on training your voice, and it's a total life. It's not like an actor can go away and drink and get in the pub and have fun and do this stuff. These guys are, it's a delicate instrument. They're thoroughbreds. These are the best in the world. But so teaching is a vital part of fight directing. So point at your targets. Point, 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 point. Now, as you do it, look at me the whole time. Think of down.
Right.
You know when you're singing those high notes? Think of down, yeah?
Gravity.
There you go. Down. So, yeah, that's good. Now, think of looking at your watch. You look at your watch when you do the left show. And look at your watch. Perfect. And again. Back again. There. There. Look at your watch. There. Look at your watch. Close your eyes. There. Yes. 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 Good. Nice stuff. Yeah. Perfect.
Are the skills that your actors learn on stage transferable? In other words, if one of these opera guys went out to a bar and got into a brawl.
No. There was an actor I think called Michael Redfern and got into a fight in the bar, and I've been teaching him fights and whatever. And this guy came at him and he blocked it and he pulled the punch, and the guy looked down and went, "Jesus!" and ran out the bar because he thought that Michael could actually hurt him. And Michael just pulled. No. Don't even go there. You do not try this at home. It's theatre. It's make believe.
What is the scene we're about to observe?
There's in the play, and also in the opera, is the moment when Michael Cassio, who is the lieutenant to Othello, gets drunk, and gets into a fight with one of the captains of the guard. Within that, there are lots of things that happen. Michael Cassio has a group of people that move with him. Their job is to try and get him out of there before he does some real damage, and they don't succeed. That's where the director part comes in, like looking at the story and how I can move it forward. Also, I look at the actors in the fight, and I often will say to them, what would be missing if your character didn't fight? And then that answer will give me what I need to do to choreograph it. What I'm trying to do, or trying to create now, is the thing that we couldn't do before when we were working on the initial production, which was your guy's involvement with Cassio. I never knew what that was. You came in with him, and then you're fighting him. Chris was saying something. You had a point yesterday, and I wanted to kind of...
I was like, why am I not stopping him right here?
Right. And I think the answer to that question is, he is the captain of the guard. Now, he is the person who you came in and you thought he's going to, maybe one of two of you thinking he gets like this when he drinks, so maybe that apprehension when he drinks can be there early on. No? Yes? Lexi, can we do that move from swipe at Chris? Swipe at Chris? But he doesn't even need to swipe. I mean, come in and just look at him. There. And you move away from it, yeah? It says something about the character. And it says something about your position in the role of his guard. We have to give him an enormous degree of importance because he has to lose all that when Othello comes.
I would imagine some scenes require realism and others a bit of theatricality.
Yeah, you have to be careful because if you get too real, the audience gets scared for the performers. The fine line between being theatrical and being real is very fine. And so I think that we don't look for reality in theatre. We look for the representation of reality. And if we're pushed too far in that direction, we're moved out of the theatre into something entirely different. So that kind of helps a little bit, huh? All right, go.
Easy, man. Left leg.
Right shoulder.
Head.
Left shoulder.
Shoulder.
Good.
You go that way.
See, that's a moment in which the sword went near to the performer and we went, whoa, that was the reality moment. And that's, we have to take that out, because otherwise the audience would think, oh, again, you got hit.
Good. Well, can we do that one more time and not have Chris die?
What's he's going on my shoulder or my head?
Head. I mean, it's...
Have you been in any real fights?
No. Not since I was 13. I put a kid in hospital and that was it. I never lost my temper since. I walked out. I think I don't know what I would do if I did hit somebody.
Are there any real-world examples of violence that have informed your work on stage?
Oh, God, the world is so full of violence. I don't know. I feel... I'm sad. Yeah. Boy, that was a moment. I don't want this violent stuff to be hanging around. It's stupid. People beating the crap out of each other. You know, talk and it works. But just fighting is wrong. Wrong. Shooting, God, I don't know. But I am, in a way, it makes me feel better that I've said something. And violence, you can say something about, not violence. If I thought for one moment somebody picked up a knife to stab somebody but had an image of something that I created and they stopped, I would feel wonderful. That would be tremendous.
B.H. Barry, a fight director at the Metropolitan Opera. He talked with David Cortaba of The New Yorker. The Met's production of Verdi's Otello opens this week. And that's it. We're done for now. I hope you enjoyed the show, and I hope you'll join us next week.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. Our team includes Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, Sarah Nix, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Emily Mann and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.